Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's activities inside and outside of the Supreme Court as the nine justices take up the constitutionality of the President's Affordable Care Act. Elizabeth Wydra, the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, joins us. She has frequently participated in Supreme Court litigation and we will assess the argument so far and the likely outcome. Then Dr. Margaret Flowers joins us. She is a pediatrician and an organizer with the National Occupation of Washington, D.C., and a congressional fellow for Physicians for a National Healthcare Program and a member of the board of Healthcare Now. She'll be rallying tomorrow, and people rally today on the steps of the Supreme Court in support of an amicus brief she and 50 other doctors filed with the Supreme Court to strike down the individual mandate and institute single payer now. Then finally, we will look into the President's remarks today, both on the record and off, in South Korea at a global summit focusing on securing fissile nuclear material. John Steinbrenner, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and the Chairman of the Board of the Arms Control Association, joins us to discuss the state of both nuclear arms reductions and efforts at nuclear non-proliferation. Joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Previously, she was an attorney working with former Stanford Law School Dean Kathleen Sullivan in the firm's Supreme Court Appellate Practice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's great to be here with you, Ian.
And you were inside the court today, and it seems to me that, at least from what I understand, most of the discussions today were about an obscure 1867 law, the Anti-Injunction Act.
Yeah, that's right. You know, today was really sort of the prelude to the main event, which will be tomorrow when the court hears arguments on the constitutionality of the minimum coverage provision, or the so-called individual mandate, and Wednesday, when the court will hear argument on whether the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid to cover approximately 16 million more low-income Americans is constitutional. But the issue today, while it may be a little drier than some of the issues to come, is very important, because what it really was about was whether the challenge to the Affordable Care Act and the mandate in particular was premature. This old law that you talked about, the Anti-Injunction Act, says that generally, if you want to challenge the legality of a tax, you have to pay the tax first and then sue and collect a refund if you're successful. So because the Obama administration, as one of its many arguments in support of the constitutionality of the mandate, has argued that the mandate can be upheld as a tax, then arguably that law, the Anti-Injunction Act, would come into play and would mean that the mandate couldn't be challenged until it goes into effect in 2014, or when the person pays the penalty for failing to comply with the mandate, probably on their 2015 tax returns.
So it seems to me that that's the only mechanism that the government has in terms of penalties. And now, I know there were lots of arguments about whether it's a penalty or a tax, but we'll get to that in a moment. But my understanding is that, I guess the way it's structured is that the only way that you can force people to buy insurance and penalize them if they don't is through their tax returns. My understanding is that there are no liens and none of the typical stuff that go on with collection agencies and such. So I'm wondering whether in fact this is a mandate, given the kind of squishy nature of it.
Right. I mean, you know, and that was explored a little bit today, because the tricky part of all of this, at least with today's argument, is that the Obama administration agrees with the 26 states who have sued to have the Affordable Care Act declared unconstitutional. Both sides agree that they don't want the Anti-Injunction Act to delay a ruling on the merits until 2014. They both just want closure on the issue and would prefer that the Supreme Court get to the actual substance of the dispute and determine whether or not the act is constitutional. So it's a little bit tricky for the Obama administration because they're in the position which they were today where they're saying, oh, it's not a tax with respect to the Anti-Injunction Act, so you don't have to pay the tax first and then sue later. Oh, but it's also a tax for the purposes of the Constitution when we talk about Congress's power to tax and spend. So the Obama administration's lawyer is doing quite a tap dance to try to get around that. But none of the justices today, this morning in court, seemed that eager to delay a ruling on the merits. I think that they understand that on both sides of the issue, people who are opposed to the law and people who support it, you know, want to know sooner rather than later whether this law is going into effect, and particularly for the millions of Americans who are already enjoying the benefits of the law, you know, millions of seniors and women who are getting preventive care for free under the Affordable Care Act, and millions of young Americans who are able to stay on their parents' insurance plan, just as two examples. You know, to have those benefits taken away from them after they've come to rely on them would be a major disappointment. And so I think that the court will probably find that there are exceptions to this rule, that even if something appears to be a tax, you challenge it after you've paid it. I think that they will find a way to get to the merits of the case. And frankly, I think that's probably a wise decision, even though this is an election year and some folks think that a decision now will be overly political.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wider, the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and she has frequently participated in Supreme Court litigation and was in the Supreme Court today hearing arguments. Apparently, the Solicitor General making the arguments on behalf of the Affordable Care Act, Donald Varelli. He, as you mentioned, well, you didn't mention, but Justice Alito said to him, you know, you're arguing that a penalty is not a tax and tomorrow you're going to be back and you'll be arguing that the penalty is a tax. At one point there, apparently, he himself got a little flustered and so Breyer had to correct him, right?
Right. You know, I mean, and Justice Alito is right. Solicitor General Varelli will be back in court tomorrow, saying that the penalty for failing to comply with the individual mandate is a constitutional tax. And there is a technical argument that he made that would allow the court to say, okay, it's a tax for the constitutional purposes, but not a tax for the Anti-Injunction Act. Basically, the argument is that, well, Congress didn't say that it wanted the Anti-Injunction Act to apply, so therefore it doesn't. But it is very delicate. I think fortunately for General Verrilli, he has two other very good arguments to support the constitutionality of the mandate, because I do think from the questions today from Justice Breyer, Justice Alito, and even some of the more liberal justices like Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Kagan, there was some skepticism about whether or not the penalty that goes along with not complying with the mandate is actually a tax intended to raise revenue, et cetera, instead of a penalty that one pays for failing to engage in the conduct that the minimum coverage provision requires.
So, Elizabeth Wider, apparently it was a pretty lively day there in front of the Supreme Court. I believe at one point Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sotomayor all started speaking at the same time, which prompted the Chief Justice to act as a kind of traffic cop. And, of course, needs to say, Clarence Thomas remained silent.
Yeah, he certainly did. You know, it was interesting that, you know, the three female justices, and I am just so thrilled that we have three female justices on the court right now because they're all brilliant and very good at what they do. They were all three very active in questioning today. And some of the more conservative justices, like Justice Scalia and in many instances, Justice Kennedy were not quite as active as they often are. Justice Scalia usually, he's usually the one talking at the same time as everyone else. But it was a lively scene inside, but I have to say, I think it was even livelier outside on the plaza outside the Supreme Court building.
Well, you had Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum grandstanding there, and apparently you had demonstrators pro and con. The CNN has an interesting poll that say 43% of Americans approve of the law, 50% say they disapprove, but of that 50%, only 37% say they oppose the law because it's too liberal. And 10% say they oppose the measure because it's not liberal enough. And I take it all factions were out there today.
Yeah, you know, it was really civil for the most part. You know, certainly people's beliefs were passionately held, and there was a little bit of heckling, but all sides were represented. And it was quite a scene. You know, you talk about how it was kind of a circus, and then at one point I turned around and there was a cat on a leash, and then I thought, well, this really is a circus.
Well, there was a brass band, wasn't there?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Right. So there were also inside, apparently, the Attorney General, Kathleen Sebelius, the head of Health and Human Services, U.S. Senator Sessions was in there too. So what's just the atmosphere there? Because you get the feeling that this is obviously it is a big deal. Although it just is, I talked to John Dean and a few other legal scholars the other day, and they say that it's highly unlikely. I mean, so that it'll be overturned. Maybe it'll be 6-3 and upholding it or something along those lines. That seems to be the betting from those particular insiders. So how do you explain the idea that this is supposed to be a cliffhanger, but it may not be a cliffhanger?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. When these suits first were brought, when the litigation first was filed, you know, just moments after President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, the consensus from legal scholars was that these were frivolous suits. And, you know, I think that they, I still believe that they lack legal merit, but it's, we should all be concerned that these lawsuits have gone from everyone sort of agreeing they're frivolous. In fact, Ronald Reagan's former Solicitor General, Charles Freed, said that he would eat his hat if they were successful. So have now gone to something that people think could go either way. I don't think the Constitution has any support for the arguments that these conservative leaders of 26 states are making. I think they're much more political arguments, and I think they've gained a lot of salience because the politicians making the arguments are very good at their message. But I think ultimately when it comes down to the court having to take a hard look at Supreme Court precedent from the founding to the present and the text and history of the Constitution, I really do hope that if they do not allow sort of politics to get in the way, that we will have a strong majority of justices, including, I think, several conservative justices who will uphold the law.
Well, it you know, the reason one has to be a little leery and nervous, perhaps, is because of Citizens United.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. They're capable of doing strange and radical things. Just in terms of, just in closing, though, I'm just personally mystified. I saw a poll the other day, or I think it was a Pew Center did a study. Most of the opposition, of course, the Republican candidates for president are all castigating Obamacare, and it's become a ritual in the primaries. But the support for repealing Obamacare, and it's tied up with all of this nonsense about him being a Muslim and not being an American, and all of the strange beliefs out there in that with that constituency. But the truth of the matter is that the red states that oppose it have the worst healthcare outcomes in the country and the lowest number of insured. So that's this part of it that I find mystifying.
I think it's very unfortunate that there's been so much misinformation being spread about the law. One of the major achievements of the law is the expansion of the Medicaid program, which provides millions and millions of Americans, the most vulnerable among us, with access to quality, affordable care. And the fact that that has been demonized into some sort of, you know, big government overreach is really sad. And I think that it's great that Americans are engaged with the Constitution. But, you know, when you have this Tea Party rhetoric about the Constitution that convinces people that, you know, beneficial laws like this are somehow, you know, contrary to our founding charter, you know, that's just wrong. And it's not wrong just as a matter of politics, although I think you make a good argument for that, but it's wrong as a matter of the Constitution. And, you know, I carry a Constitution with me, like a lot of those Tea Partiers claim they do, but what they are talking about is not what's in the Constitution. I think they're reading the Articles of Confederation, which was the sort of, you know, rough draft that we had before our founders actually wrote our enduring Constitution that gives the national government the authority to provide solutions for national problems. And that's exactly what Congress did with the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, well, it should be a part of the pursuit of happiness and the general welfare, one would think. But I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Wydra.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Previously, she was an attorney working with former Stanford Law School Dean Kathleen Sullivan in the firm Supreme Court Appellate Practice, and she was in the Supreme Court today. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Dr. Margaret Flowers, an advocate for single-payer health care.
So no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor,
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Margaret Flowers, a Maryland pediatrician and an organizer with the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. She is currently working on single-payer health care reform full-time, in addition to her activities as co-chair of the Maryland chapter and congressional fellow for physicians for a national health program. Dr. Flowers is on the board of Healthcare Now and on the steering committee of the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Margaret Flowers.
Thank you for having me on today.
And about a month ago, you and 50 other doctors and two nonprofit groups filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court calling for them to strike down the Obamacare, I'm using the conservative majority, the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate and replacing it with single payer now. Will you get a hearing or a reading or whatever is involved?
That's a good question. I doubt that we'll get a hearing of it. It's possible that we may have a minority opinion that would be written about it. But basically, we wanted to make sure that it was known, and this is something that may be read in legal journals so that it does reach a new audience. But we wanted to make it known that the individual mandate is not a solution to our health care crisis in this country. It's not necessary. In fact, it would not be sufficient. And that we do have models in the United States, our own Medicare and our VA system, which perform much better than our private insurance, and they have better outcomes, and they control costs in a better way.
Well, this Affordable Care Act was a creature of a kind of compact with the insurance companies to get them in early. Clinton tried it to bring them into the tent, but then they turned on him with the ads from the two actors playing, I think, can't remember, Louise and Harry or something.
Right.
I don't recall the names, but a similar thing seemed to have happened here. He got they came in, they wrote the ground rules for this bill, and then they sort of somewhat turned against him, even though they're the beneficiaries of it. It's obviously hung up over the individual mandate of whether it's a tax or penalty. Those are the arguments today. Tomorrow, apparently, is the big day. You're going to be there tomorrow, Ryan.
Yes, we will be down there tomorrow. The two things they need to look at in terms of deciding whether the individual mandate is constitutional or not is first, using the Commerce Clause, can you force people to purchase a private product? But then second, is it necessary to force people to purchase that product in order to meet the need of our society? So in this case, healthcare. If we look at Massachusetts, which is where this model type of reform was passed back in 2006, it's very clear that it's going to perform, it's performing about the same way that we estimate it will at the national level. So about half of the people that were uninsured at the beginning of the Massachusetts bill are now insured. What they are insured with, though, is a flawed product. Private insurance in this country is not protective. There still continue to be significant barriers to care in terms of copays and deductibles or not covered, services that are not covered. The primary cause of bankruptcy in our country is due to medical costs, and about 80% of the people that go bankrupt due to medical costs have health insurance. So it just simply doesn't work, and we believe that the evidence shows that forcing people to purchase private insurance is a false sense of security. It makes them think they're going to be able to get health care, but in fact it further privatizes our health care system, which as a result is very expensive and leaves too many people out.
So, but of course you were never allowed in on the original negotiations, were you, really? I mean, your argument, and others, of course, have the same argument about single payer. The door has been closed on it with this act, and if it's ratified, it'll be even more difficult. I mean, I recall, Dr. Flowers, weren't you arrested in the committee hearings early of trying to make your case before Senator Max Baucus?
That's correct. In May of 2009, the Senate Finance Committee was the first committee to take up health reform. They actually, presented the white paper, which was written by a former senior vice president of public policy from WellPoint, one of the largest insurance companies in the U.S., and they were only allowing industry people to testify. And so there were eight of us, including three doctors and two lawyers, all of us single-payer advocates, who stood up in the committee and asked why the single-payer viewpoint was not being heard. This, of course, was following many visits that we had with members of Congress asking to be included, and we were arrested for standing up and saying that. Now, I did testify in the next Senate committee, and we testified in the House, but as you know, this bill was, made through deals with the industry before, it was even put into, put down on paper. And so what it is, it's a bill that further enriches the industries that are getting wealthy off of healthcare, does not address our problems. It's going to continue to leave tens of millions of people with no coverage at all. Half of the people that get new coverage will be in Medicaid, which is not an ideal system by any means. The employer-sponsored insurance, there was just a report from the Congressional Budget Office a few weeks ago saying that about 20 million people are going to lose their employer-sponsored health insurance and be pushed out into the individual market, where insurance is more expensive and is skimpier, has higher copays and deductibles. And this bill is not going to control our health care costs, which are a significant reason why we have a deficit in this country. So it's just, the bill is already in some ways falling apart There had to be over 1,000 waivers given out from the Department of Health and Human Services. It doesn't get fully implemented until 2019. It's our opinion that we really need to stop this, you know, kind of shenanigans and really go to a serious evidence-based healthcare system, which is an improved Medicare for all.
And as you said, Congress has already created two limited single-payer systems, Medicare and the Veterans Health Benefits System. I'm curious to know, is Dick Cheney being kept alive by single-payer?
That's a very good question. I don't know what his insurance is. I imagine... he probably does have some significant public funding to his health care, something that the rest of us wish that we would have.
Mm. Well, you're demonstrating tomorrow, but people were demonstrating on all sides of it today, for and against the Affordable Care Act. And CNN has a poll out that says 43% of Americans approve of the law, 50% say they disapprove of the law, and of that 50%, 37% say they oppose the law because it's too liberal. But then 10% of that 50% say they oppose the law because it's not liberal enough. So do you? You're obviously a part of that 10%. I know you're also a part of the 99%, right?
Right.
But tell me about your 10%. Is that an accurate figure? Because everybody I know, maybe I know too many progressives, always felt that it was a mistake not to go the sink, that just to expand on the pre-existing Medicare model and not to go this insurance company route. But of course, right, our government is, and our country is owned by corporations. Who in turn own our politicians. So
that's correct. I mean, this is a Medicare for All system is really an evidence-based system. It's very clear. It's not even a question around the world. The countries that use a publicly financed universal health system have a better health outcomes, greater satisfaction. They have lower health care costs. And we know that, clearly, solidly, for about two decades of polling, we've seen that around 60 to 65% of Americans favor a single-payer health system. The majority of physicians do as well, and this is despite the fact that we have a corporate media that consistently portrays single-payer in a negative light, but people still favor it. 80% of Democrats favor a single-payer system. So, you know, for the Democrats, when they were in power in 2009, 2010, to dismiss it completely just shows us so clearly that both of the major parties, the Republicans and the Democratic parties, are controlled by their corporate funders. And if we want serious public policy, it's going to have to come from the people coming together, forming an independent, broad-based social and economic justice movement that demands it.
Well, Dr. Margaret Flowers, it seems like you're planning on something along those lines, aren't you, with the national occupation of Washington, D.C. You're one of the organizers. It begins on March the 30th and ends on April the 30th. And on April the 2nd, you're having a conference at the Carnegie Institute in Washington, D.C. called Control the Corporation. Tell us more about that.
My daughter needed something more immediately. Well, yes, we actually we organized an occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. last October, and we had started planning in April before the Occupy movement came together, because so many of us that were advocating for issues of social, economic, and environmental justice and, advocating against our wars of aggression found that we were running into the same obstacles, that Congress is controlled by their corporate funders, by concentrated wealth, and that public policy was not based on what the majority of people in the United States want or even on sound public policy. And so, evidence-based policy. So that was a first step, was that occupation in D.C. We did some campaigns around the Super Committee trying to prevent them from cutting Medicare and Social Security. And we see this as a next step, is this one-month occupation that will focus on education. For the first 2 weeks, we'll be having the social forum in addition to the Controlling the Corporations Conference, which is a full day that's focused really on strategy. We've had discussions in D.C. kind of like diagnosing what the problems are, and now it's time for us to come up with a treatment plan. And that's what April 2nd is really going to be about. And it is an open conference for people who would like to come. It's free. They can register online through our website, nowdc.org. And in the second 2 weeks when Congress is in town, we'll be focused on direct action and protest to bring visibility to the issues that are important to, you know, those of us who advocate for social and economic justice.
So, Dr. Margaret Flowers, it strikes me as being incredibly tragic and ironic that most of the opposition to health care reform in this country, and it's become a mantra with the Republican presidential candidates, Obamacare, are in the red states. And a recent study, I think by the Pew Research Institute, indicated that the red states in this country have the worst healthcare outcomes and the highest numbers of uninsured. I've spoken a few times to the founder of Remote Area Medical, and he goes out, great guy, and he goes out and gives free medical care in rural areas and in some urban areas. And the tragedy is that the very people who flock to get free medical care are the ones that are buying this anti-healthcare reform. I mean, without getting into the enemy of the good, of the good is the perfect. Just in general, it is. This strikes me as an extraordinary tragedy. And also, Stan was telling me that when they poll the people who come in who need healthcare, almost 100% of them first want dental health care and secondly want eye care. And the rest, only a minority want to see doctors. So what does that tell us about what's being done so far in terms of health care? Shouldn't dentistry have been a big part of it?
Absolutely. Our dental outcomes are quite appalling, and vision as well, because these are benefits that are not traditionally covered in insurance in the U.S. And I mean, this is ridiculous because we're spending, in many cases, twice what on healthcare per person what other industrialized nations spend, and those nations cover everybody and they have better health outcomes than we do. So it's we have the resources in this country. We have everything that we need to create a high quality national healthcare system that's universal and lifelong. And we have the majority of the people with us, but we have this corporate controlled Congress and a very propagandized population, which does act against their own best interests.
Well, but just in closing, they're being propagandized to oppose Obamacare. It's not front-loaded, so people don't recognize the benefits that are in it. Obviously, you think they should have gone another way, but just pragmatically, can you build on it or just you scrap the whole thing and then we end up with nothing?
Well, we don't really see that we can build on the Affordable Care Act and turn that into a health system. We see that the two smallest incremental steps that we need to take in order to turn healthcare around in this country and actually start creating a system that's based on improving the health of our population is to create a system, a coordinated system, where we use our health resources in a way that makes sense, and also to take the money that we're spending and use that to pay for healthcare, and that's done most efficiently through a single-payer system. In addition to this, we really have to address the issues of wealth inequality in this country because we can't create a healthy population if we don't address those issues as well, and that could be a whole other show. So I think the Affordable Care Act, unfortunately, takes us in the direction of further privatizing our health care, and we need to go in the opposite direction and create a single-payer system now. Too many people are suffering and dying because we're not doing that, and that's just not acceptable.
And as I was mentioning, the evidence is so clear of the great need when the remote area medical people go out to these communities. It's tragic how many people don't have even basic health care, and it put things off to the tremendous detriment to their health. So it's a sad picture when you really really scratch the surface of what's really happening in this country. Yeah,
it's commonplace in our society. You can't go anywhere without hearing these stories.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Margaret Flowers.
Thank you for having me on.
Again, Dr. Margaret Flowers, a Maryland pediatrician and an organizer with the National Occupation in Washington, D.C. She's currently working on single-payer health care reform full-time in addition to her activity as co-chair of the Maryland chapter and a congressional fellow for Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Flowers is on the board of Healthcare Now and on the steering committee of the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the summit in South Korea to secure loose nukes.
The Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Steinbrenner, who's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International and Security Studies. He has authored and edited a number of books, including The Cybernetic Theory of Decision, New Dimensions of Political Analysis, Principles of Global Security, and A New Concept of Cooperative Security. He co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and is chairman of the board of the Armed Control Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Steinbrenner.
Thank you very much.
And it seems that the summit in South Korea, leaders of 54 nations are gathering ostensibly to talk about nuclear security and getting more than 50 nations to secure or give up their nuclear material, but it's been largely overshadowed by North Korea. North Korea has a peculiar ability of, in spite of its impoverished, pathetic state of affairs, it manages to capture headlines, and in this case, it seems to be upstaging the entire world.
It certainly does seem to have dominated the news coming out of the summit. Unless you're there, it's hard to tell how much it's actually dominated the summit discussion, but it certainly has dominated the news reporting about it.
And in terms of arms control, at least in the traditional sense, the old Cold War sense, is there much that's come out of the meetings with President Obama and Medvedev? Because he's leaving power, Putin's coming in. Much of, again, the press focus has been on the off-the-cuff remarks that were picked up on the microphones where, Obama's asking Medvedev for a little space so that once he gets reelected, he'll have more flexibility. And Medvedev says, yeah, I'll pass that on to Vladimir. No big headlines, but obviously, again, capturing people's attention. Any substance to the discussions that you know of?
As far as I can tell from the coverage, there hasn't been anything that would qualify as major substance. They're rehearsing well-known themes. Obama did suggest that he's interested in further reducing the number of nuclear weapons under the the START agreement, but he didn't specify a number, and it's unlikely that he will specify a number, actually, until after the election. He would, not unreasonably want to keep that out of electoral politics. And actually, the North Koreans, intentionally or otherwise, are reminding us that in a very uncomfortable way is that there are issues of equity here that are, you could say, the major powers, the United States included, are having difficulty addressing. And nobody, of course, the North Koreans are demonized in most part of the world, and almost nobody is willing to defend their perspective, given the way they present it, but they are raising an issue about why is it that they should not be allowed to launch a satellite and everybody else should be. The answer is a UN Security Council resolution back in 2006 that in reaction to their nuclear weapons test, said that they were not supposed to launch missiles or conduct further tests, and imposed, if you will, the authority of the UN Security Council to make that illegal. And given that, and given that North Korea did agree, apparently, not to conduct a test in response for food aid just very recently, they put Obama in a very awkward situation where he sort of has to defend, if you will, the diplomacy and insist that they not conduct a test, but it puts him in a position of defending an egregious inequity from almost everybody's point of view. He's been put in a very awkward situation.
Well, isn't it likely, though, that this is also, I mean, not likely, this is a pattern of North Korea negotiating. They make an agreement and then they immediately go ahead with a deal breaker, which is what they're doing now. And once they do the test, in spite of efforts to get the Chinese to dissuade them, it's likely that they'll go ahead with the test, the missile test, and then perhaps another nuclear test, and then come back to the negotiating table from a position of greater strength.
It wouldn't be a position of greater strength. I mean, it is said that that is the case, but I think in reality it is not the case. They are violating, egregiously violating international norms here because of the resolution, and they will not come back in greater strength. This is not something that you would do to gain bargaining leverage internationally. It's something you might do if you have political difficulty within your own country. And that's the better interpretation of what's going on here. It is the case that in many instances of this in the past where they seem to be breaking an agreement arbitrarily, there are hidden details where they've been provoked by details of the negotiation on our side, which somehow never really get out. I don't know that that's... I myself cannot identify such a thing in this case. It doesn't look like it would be. We've been negotiating for delivery of food aid in exchange for their not agreeing to testing, and I am unaware of any glitch in that process that might have provoked the North Koreans. But that kind of thing has happened in the past.
Just in terms of arms control, again, between the haves as opposed to the have-nots or the want-to-have-mores, the president did declare, he was actually quite passionate at times, he said flatly that the United States has more nuclear weapons than it needs and it can cut its arsenal without weakening its security or that of its allies. But then he sort of got very personal and spoke of his wish for further reductions, and as the president of the only nation to have set off a nuclear weapon in anger, he also said, as a commander of a country whose nuclear codes, the football, is never far from his side, he spoke also as a protective father, wanting to erase this threat of annihilation for future generations. How's that likely to be accepted, do you think?
Oh, those are very welcome words to everyone. And I think most of the world is willing to believe that he personally means it. And that is, to put it mildly, different from most of his predecessors, actually. And he's credited for that, and that probably is a good part of the reason why he was awarded the Nobel Prize based upon speeches, basically. The question is, does he have the ability, if you will, to really impose restraining outcomes? And to put it mildly, everybody looking from the outside of the American political process has a question in that sort in their mind. He's committed, but can he bring the United States along? And that is a question.
And that, of course, was one part of his comment to the outgoing Russian president.
Right.
You know, wait till after the elections.
Right. Don't push me at this moment, right? This is not something I wish to run on beyond what he's already said. I mean, he's made his... But any time he specifies any detail, he will be attacked from right-wing sources, belligerent nationalist sources, and everybody knows that. And the question is, can he really bring about meaningful restraint on the largest and most capable arsenal? I think he does get credit. He should get credit for personally wanting to do it, being quite serious about it. But his whole presidency is a question of whether he can deliver. Can he make the machinery work? And that is a question in his case.
Well, he went on to say that they're continuing to move with the Russians to eliminate enough plutonium for about 17,000 nuclear weapons, largely burning it in reactors for electricity, and that he said that when we're done, we'll cut American and Russian deployed nuclear weapons to their lowest level since the 1950s. Of course, he's also dealing now with, I'm not sure whether Putin ever went away in terms of his relationship with Medvedev, but the long and the short of it is that Putin is nominally less flexible and perhaps even more hostile to the U.S., and they do have some problems over Syria. So do you think it's not just a question of after the elections? I think we're dealing with a different Russia now, aren't we?
It's a marginally different Russia. Putin has always been sort of a major figure behind the scenes. But it will be difficult. It has all along been difficult to take steps beyond the New START treaty. The Russians welcome, I think, further reductions, but they have problems with conventional forces as well. And we would, too, if we were in their position. They are highly exposed to sophisticated attack from conventional air, and they have very little reassurance in that regard. Now, I think it's likely that they will go along with further reductions because they, in fact, are probably intending to maintain a smaller arsenal anyway. Both sides have, despite all the reductions that have occurred, they have much more deterrent capability than is reasonably rational. It's still in excess. Both sides have plenty of room to reduce the size of their deployments and not have any diminishing effect on their deterrent capability at all.
But what about the incentive to save money on both sides? Surely there's some on our side.
There is some, and it's significant but not dominant. It's conventional forces that are that absorb most of the money, and that's where the biggest disparity in capability is. And as yet, reassurance to the Russians in that regard is not yet on the table, and will probably have to be put on the table if we're to get into truly meaningful extensions. You might get a reduction in the number of 1,000 is frequently mentioned, 1,500 down to 1,000. That can readily be done without changing anything in terms of deterrent capability. And the Russians probably are willing to go that low without anything else. Beyond that, bringing in the sort of the theater range systems on the Russian side, which we talk a lot about, is going to have a broader negotiation also dealing with conventional force issues. And we're not as yet prepared for that. At least there's been very little talk about that and very little indication that the government as a whole is prepared for that discussion.
So, John Steinbrenner, again, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International and Security Studies and the Chairman of the Board of the Arms Control Association. You mentioned earlier in response to President Obama's speech at the Summit to Secure Nuclear Materials in Seoul, South Korea, where he spoke from the heart, that was welcome, and in contrast to his predecessors, it seems to me that even in our conversation, there's a difference between the arms control regimes of the past with the Soviet Union and the current, and the successor Russian regime are a whole different kettle of fish compared to the issues that are involved in non-proliferation and in particularly in terms of Iran and North Korea. But it seems to me that the biggest damage that was ever done in terms of non-proliferation regimes is what George W. Bush did with Iraq, that he and his regime essentially lied us into a war based upon the threat of nuclear weapons, which turned out to be non-existent. And surely that sent a message to everybody around the world that you better get your nuclear weapons first because, you'll have some leverage. That's just my opinion. I don't mean to impose my opinion, but that's my opinion.
And it's a common thought. But when you get down to the realities of it, neither Iran nor North Korea are in any position to be protected rather than threatened by nuclear weapons in their possession. The North Koreans probably do understand that. They're playing a very weak hand, and they walked a very fine line, trying to bring about basically a deal whereby they are given security assurances, i.e. we will not try to overthrow you by force, we will tolerate your regime, and we will remove sanctions. That's what they're clearly after. It's reasonable supposition that that's what the Iranians are after, too. Despite all our proclamations about what we think they think they're doing, the reality of it is that Iran, in particular, has very poor prospect of actually safely acquiring a nuclear weapon. They have not legitimized that. They've said that they're not trying to do it. They turn around and said, oh, well, we changed our mind, or we were lying about that. It would be very dangerous to them. And you have to believe, and because there's a lot of diplomatic record there, too, they also are trying to get an outcome whereby they are allowed enrichment capability, as they say, as a national sovereign right, which it is, but it's also a hedge that, you know, if you push us too hard, we really could do this, so don't drive us over the brink. And it's reasonable for them to stop at that point and to say, okay, we have a subliminal deterrent the way, say, the Japanese do, and lots of other countries as well that have highly enriched or plutonium, separated plutonium stocks. They're not displaying an active deterrent, but they're displaying the capacity to do it in reasonably short order if they're pushed too hard, and that's a reasonable outcome from their point of view. From ours as well, it keeps them short of a weapon. We do not want to have them a weapon. And that deal wants to be discussed and needs to be directly discussed, and it's not clear what's holding it up. I mean, the Iranians appear to be ready to talk about that, and the U.S. seems to be reluctant, and it's not clear why we would be reluctant to talk about that.
Well, but the talk that is going on is whether or not Israel will strike preemptively, whether they'll do it with or without U.S. permission. And there is a lot of speculation that in order for President Obama to dissuade Netanyahu from doing something before the elections, which would at the very least cause the price of gasoline to rise precipitously, that there may be some kind of agreement that something will be done after the elections. So at this point, it seems that we're talking mostly about the choice between preemptive strikes or diplomacy, and the preponderance of what we hear in the press from the pundits is that diplomacy doesn't work with North Korea and it doesn't work with Iran.
Yeah, and that is a completely inaccurate account of both the historical record in both cases. And it is a bit alarming. The U.S. press, quite frankly, as a whole, is behaving a little bit like they behaved in the run-up to Iraq, where they, you know, they took the bait and ran with it. Whereas anybody who really knew anything was listening to the IAEA knew that Iraq did not have nuclear weapons. That was really not a question. But it was presented as a question, and the U.S. claim that it did was presented as a credible statement in the American press running up to that thing. This is sort of vaguely reminiscent of it. The people who know about the situation know that Iran has proposed compromise arrangements which would keep them short of a nuclear weapon, reliably short of a nuclear weapon. And that is what diplomacy ought to be doing, is discussing that outcome, because it's the only good outcome, actually. But both sides are posturing, and yes, the Israelis are, particularly Netanyahu, is threatening this. The kindest thing you can say about it is that it's political theater and he knows it. Beyond that, it is insanity, frankly, because that's the one way in which you would legitimize an Iranian nuclear program, is attack them. Then the rest of the world will say, okay, well, they're going to have to get it. You cannot deny it by the attack. You can postpone it for some extent, but you would almost certainly push them over the brink by legitimizing getting the weapon. That's the one thing that might do it. And it is wildly irresponsible. And frankly, anybody who knows anything about the real dynamics of this understands that that would be a disaster. Israel cannot do that. We cannot do that strategically. It's both morally and strategically indefensible. And yes, there are, you know, pundits arguing the contrary, but, you know, they really are extremists. There really is a consensus for people who know anything that an attack would be disastrous, and particularly given that the diplomatic formula is there to be grabbed. Many of us are very alarmed by the drumbeat of war. It is irrational, it is unrealistic, and yet you're right that that is the dominant theme as you read the American press.
Well, just in closing, John Steinbrenner, you've made a very strong case that Iran, that diplomacy, the diplomatic track is doable with Iran, and that they want a situation not unlike the situation that Japan has, where they have nuclear capability in terms of fuel, but have not moved towards a weapon. And other, I believe, you know, back in the 60s, the Swedes even went to that point and stepped back. Let's just, in the last minute there, turn to North Korea. Back in 1994, President Clinton apparently was considering a preemptive strike to prevent North Koreans going nuclear. Jimmy Carter went over there on his own on an emergency mission, feeling that that there was a that they were on a dangerous collision course. What's your assessment of the possibility of the same kind of diplomacy that the Iranians appear to be open to being exercised with North Korea?
Well, North Korea is already, the formula for North Korea has already been stated repeatedly, and we're still in this lengthy process of trying to implement it. The formula is they give up their entire program in a reasonably verifiable way, and we remove economic sanctions, and we basically give them assurances that we will not attack them if they don't attack us, of course. We will not initiate attack, i.e., we will not try to change your regime by force. That's the formula for North Korea. It's pretty clear all along that's what's been after, and that's what the six-party talks were all about, trying to bring that about. That's the outcome in North Korea. It's also the logical outcome in Iran.
So again, you think the hawks are dominating the debate?
Less so on North Korea than in Iran, but yeah, I mean, North Korea has no proponents, zero proponents in the United States. Nobody is willing to stand up and say, okay, they say flamboyant things, et cetera, but here's their point of view. Nobody is willing to do that. Mm-hmm. They can be blamed for that. They've done a lot to deserve that, but that isn't good diplomacy, is to demonize your opponent who is actually trying to come to accommodation. But as a result, in U.S. political dialogue, North Korean perspectives are legitimate perspectives are never presented. They're always presented as irrational, belligerent bargainers. And, you know, of course, they do a lot to sort of earn that image. However, the details, if you go look at the diplomatic details, throughout from 94 onward, it's pretty clear what they've been trying to do. They've been trying to turn in the nuclear program in exchange for international rehabilitation. It's the major card in their hand. They've been trying to play it. It's kind of a land peace formula. They're willing to give up the land. They can't get the peace. That's their problem.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Steinbrenner.
Okay, take care.
You too. Again, I was speaking with John Steinbrenner, who's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International Security Studies. He has authored and edited a number of books, including The Cybernetic Theory of Decision, New Dimensions of Political Analysis, Principles of Global Security, and A New Concept of Cooperative Security. He co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and is chairman of the board of the Arms Control Association. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.